ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to ID, the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, I'm sharing with you part one of a great conversation between Dr. Stephen Meyer and UC San Diego physicist Brian Keating on Keating's podcast, Into the Impossible. Keating is Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. Dr. Keating's website is briankeating.com. The topic of their conversation is Dr. Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. They speak for an hour and a half about a range of questions related to Dr. Meyer's work and the new book. We'll share the first half hour with you now.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Into the Impossible podcast. And today, I am joined by a very interesting individual, someone I have spoken about before on the podcast and in my day job as a practicing cosmologist. And that is Dr. Stephen Meyer, who is joining us. He is at the Discovery Institute, and I will give a proper introduction to him as we go on. But the occasion of today's podcast interview, which is years in the making because I've known of his work for many, many years, I've followed him and admired what he does and the role that he plays in the philosophy of science and even in, as you'll find out, intelligent design. What is this? Keating, a respected cosmologist, is now getting into intelligent design. Well, you'll find out. And as I said in the encomia that I gave to this new book by our wonderful guest today, called The Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen C. Meyer. He's the author of the breakaway best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt, The Signature in the Cell, many other books and works of really outreach and scientific communication. And it's such a treat to be with you today, Stephen, and I'm so enamored of your prodigious workload. How do you do it? How do you possibly do this tremendous output that you do and still have some semblance of sanity left over?
Well, I could ask you the same thing, actually, with your practicing day job at the forefront of cosmology and also work putting out very, very fine books yourself. So it's once I got liberated from full-time teaching, I was able to write quite a bit more. So that's been the secret, I think. I was a professor for 12 years and then came to Discovery and have been more focused on the research.
Right. So I want to just read your quick bio that I received. And this should be familiar to many of my listeners because they may have encountered you already in your debates with none other than upcoming guest Dr. Lawrence Krauss of the Origins Project and the Origins Podcast. Hopefully Lawrence is coming on not too long from now. And Lawrence plays a not insignificant role in the God Hypothesis. I wonder, did you send him an advanced copy of this book?
I will send it out.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, we'll get him a signed copy.
I think he and I have dueling essays in a journal inference coming up soon.
So, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So I received
He's a worthy intellectual interlocutor for sure. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And the odd couple, if ever there were one. So I received this book in the mail at UCSD, and I opened it up and I said, "Oh, Stephen's got a new book." I didn't know that. It was December 7th. I know because it's a day that will live in infamy for many reasons. And I got this book and it said, "Stephen Meyer received his PhD from Cambridge University in the philosophy of science. A former geophysicist and college professor, he directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He authored the New York Times bestselling Darwin's Doubt, Signature in the Cell." Which was selected as a London Times Literary Supplement Book of the Year. It's been featured on PBS, Ben Shapiro, et cetera, et cetera. And it said, "Professor Keating, you know, we're so pleased to present to you this galley copy." So this is not the original copy. And it said, "We'd be so pleased if you'd get us some comment on the book by December 15th. And, you know, Stephen doesn't write books by the pound, but if he did, he'd be even more replete and munificently remunerated than he is. This book is like 600 pages long. So I said, I can't do that. You got to give me at least 8 days, 9 days, Stephen, come on. But actually I tore through it. Of course, I looked up my name in it, made sure that I was featured prominently as a couple of chapters befitting my own personal resplendence. But this book is so thoroughly researched. It really is kind of like a mini PhD in the philosophy of science. It is dense. I took billions of notes on the hard copy. I'm going to get the audiobook version. But I want to first start off with the question that my audience is going to ask. Why are you on this show? Why are you an intelligent design advocate on a show with a practicing cosmologist who professes that he is a devout practicing agnostic on not an infrequent basis? So what makes you and some of the work that you do, what brings attention, maybe even controversy, to the work that you do?
Well, one of the things that you have said that I like is that you're an agnostic who wrestles with God. You're interested in the big questions, and I am too. And I think that's a common interest that we have. What does science have to say about these larger metaphysical or worldview issues, if anything? I think it actually has quite a lot to say. And I think there are design implications in cosmology and physics every bit as much as in biology. I think we do live in a universe that has evidence of design and purpose. And I think that means that science may have some clues as to some of those, the answers to some of those big questions. And so I hope that makes some sense to your audience. But certainly, I think in our conversations has been one of the things that has drawn us together.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had really deep conversations. And as you know, I'm a practicing Jew. I'm not Orthodox, devout Orthodox, but I do adhere to the some of the tenets, most of the tenets of my faith. You know, it's been a long time. I haven't, you know, slept with my grandmother's, you know, ex-husband, or say, you know, there are all these mitzvot in the Torah, and people say, I can't keep it. I can't keep all those commandments. And I say, you know, did you sleep with your stepmother's wife, or, you know, whatever? And it's actually not that hard to adhere to some of these things. You know, you don't have to do that much. You know, find a red heifer and kill it. That's not something we have to do on a daily basis. But the conversation that we had, I'll just start off by saying, the thing that worried me about this book, and even, you know, conversing with folks like you or William, is it William Lane Craig or William Craig Lane? I always forget. William Lane Craig.
It's, yeah.
You always get this sort of sense as a scientist, Jewish or not, you know, that there'll be the following progression. It'll start off with the Kalam cosmological argument that, you know, anything that has a beginner anything that began must have had a beginning and must perhaps have a beginner. So cosmology, the Big Bang, the universe had a beginning, therefore there must have been a banger, as one of my rabbis says. The Big Banger is the force, the motive force that put the bang in the Big Bang. And then it'll be, well, because God wouldn't create the universe without some sense of purpose and design, therein, it is in effect a personal God. Okay, so that might follow logically from a supposition that Kalam is right or that this argument is sound. And then it will always be, and therefore Jesus. And it's very difficult as a, you know, practicing Jew, not to deny the historicity, the magnificent teachings of Jesus, the authenticity of Jesus's life and his teaching. We, as you know, as Jews, document exquisitely the teachings of all of our rabbis going back thousands of years, and Jesus was, of course, one of the most preeminent exemplars of that tradition. So I always find it interesting and a little bit perilous to engage with Christian people that are scientifically inclined to want to support the hypothesis that Jesus, more than the God hypothesis, the Jesus hypothesis. So can you say something about that? Can you read this book, which is, as I said, thoroughly documented, details the biological, cosmological, and physical implications of the evidence for design? Can you accept the contents of this book, written by a Christian, a devout Christian, if you're not Christian and perhaps have no you know, position on the legitimacy of Christ as Messiah?
Well, yeah, I mean, you and I have something else in common, which is that you're kind of a Christian-friendly Jewish person, and I'm a Jewish-friendly Christian person, and I have a lot of close colleagues in our work at Discovery who are Jewish, and right. I don't think you can settle questions specific religious questions, especially within the context of theism, through appeals to nature. I think the theologians make a distinction between general and special revelation, and the kind of arguments that I'm making are based on the general revelation of nature, and I don't think they settle those differences between Jews and Christians, or non-religious theists and Muslims, or those other sorts of considerations would have to come into play, and those conversations would have to occur separately. So this is a book simply about, it's a big topic. First, the evidence of design, but then it also addresses a second order not addressed before, which is what can science tell us about the possible identity of the designing intelligence responsible for life, for example. So that might get you to theism. I argue that it does, but it doesn't get you further than that within the framework of theism, or some sort of transcendent intelligence. Then there's other sorts of questions that would require further deliberation that can't be, I think, settled by appeals to nature.
And of course, you know, this is not a new topic. People have been kind of looking at the confrontation. Is religion engaged in a perpetual battle against science? And some of those come down to what the late, great Stephen Jay Gould called NOMA, non-overlapping magisterial support. And I actually, I've never been a huge fan of that. I always kind of find that rather bland. And that's not to say I haven't used that argument myself. I frequently have said, you know, if you pick up a book and it says, you know, great stars of the NBA, and you look through it and it's 999 pages of the, you know, seven Jews who have ever made it to the NBA, and there's one page about everybody else, then you would say, well, this is not really an accurate title for the book. And yet that same ratio takes place in the Bible, in the Old Testament, at least the Testament I'm most familiar with, in that there's about 35 verses that plausibly have to do with evolution or the Big Bang or creation of the universe out of 35,000 verses. So there's that same ratio of 1 to 1,000. And yet people want to kind of pigeonhole it as saying a couple of scientific things here, a couple of biological claims here, over there. And I really feel like that's the deepest clue that they're, it's not just that they're not overlapping, it's that they're totally irrelevant. It's like picking up a book on quantum field theory and expecting to find a way to raise your kids. So what is it about NOMA? Is it just because of Stephen Jay Gould's, you know, amazing, you know, personality and communication of science? Is there something actually there that is more than, you know, than just kind of feel good, you do what you want to do, I'll do what I want to do? Because I always say, if God exists, you're going to act very differently than if God doesn't exist, if you know God doesn't exist. So just tolerating it, you know, giving it lip service as NOMA appeals to, at least in my understanding of it, I don't find it very satisfying. Is it legitimate in some sense?
I think there's legitimacy in it. There's an old saw from Galileo, you know, the Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And that is to say, much of what we call the natural sciences concerns questions that are religiously neutral. You know, what's the formula for salt? Or what's the sort of given reaction sequence, or the specific form of the law of gravity, or whatever? But there are questions that science raises that do have larger philosophical, worldview, religious implications. What is a law of nature? From whence did the universe come? What caused the universe to come into existence? I don't adhere to NOMA, but I agree that there's some truth to it. There are vast realms of science that are religiously neutral, but there are also questions that arise in science that have philosophical worldview or religious implications. And it's at that intersection that I think that are some of the most interesting questions, the kind that you address on your podcast, for example. And that's what this book is about. What can science tell us about those big questions? One of the things I appreciate about some of the interlocutors opposite me, and that would be the very overt new atheists, is that they do a great job of framing some of those big questions. So, for example, Richard Dawkins says the universe, he asserts that the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there was no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. A blind, pitiless indifference is just a metaphorical way of describing what scholars call scientific materialism, the worldview of scientific materialism that says that there is at bottom nothing but matter and energy, that matter and energy are the things from which everything else comes, and the material, the physical universe has been eternal, is eternal and self-existent. It doesn't require an external cause to account for its origin or existence. Now, that's a very provocative claim and a very interesting one, because what Dawkins is essentially saying is that metaphysical hypotheses, every bit as much as scientific ones, might be testable by reference to observations that we can make about the world around us. And he asserts, in fact, that the metaphysical hypothesis of scientific materialism is testable, that it comports beautifully with what we would expect to see if that hypothesis were true when we go out and look at the natural world. And that's actually an excellent, I use that quote as a framing device in the book, because I want to argue just the opposite, that there are at least three big discoveries that we've made about biological and cosmological origins that are not what you'd expect if a materialistic worldview were true, but rather comport more nicely with the expectations of theism. And those three discoveries in the book are that the universe likely had a beginning, that it's been fine-tuned from the beginning and subsequent to that for life, and that there have been large bursts of digital information into our biosphere that have made new forms of life possible. And I look at those three big discoveries and suggest that they comport more nicely with theism and therefore provide what philosophers call epistemic support, not proof, but evidential or epistemic support for a theistic worldview.
What level of epistemic support is it, you know, possible to say you've achieved a status tantamount to, you know, evidentiary support? In that, you know, they say, people say, oh, that's just circumstantial evidence. But, you know, as I understand it, in the American juris system, there's a certain amount of circumstantial evidence that upon a certain amount of it will constitute enough to at least be dispositive in certain legal circumstances. So at what level would there, you know, rise to be the level of evidentiary support coming from epistemological support? And maybe just define, you know, both of those.
That's an excellent question, especially coming from a cosmologist. I mean, you know that in your field, you're reconstructing often events that took place billions of years ago, and you don't have the luxury of being able to do a controlled experiment or controlled laboratory conditions. You have to go back. You reconstruct the past based on the clues that are left behind, whether it's the cosmic background radiation or other things. And I actually did my PhD thesis on origin of life biology and the historical method of scientific investigation that's used in fields like origin of life research or evolutionary biology or archaeology or forensics or cosmology. There's a whole class of disciplines that depend upon long after the fact, circumstantial evidence in order to reconstruct processes and events that took place a long time ago. Stephen Jay Gould said that, speaking of evolutionary biology, said the historical sciences reconstruct the facts based on the clues that are left behind. So people think, well, that makes it a lesser type of science. Well, maybe, but oftentimes circumstantial evidence can be very compelling, and it is. Under the following conditions epistemologically, the problem with reasoning from effects back to causes is that there may be more than one cause that can explain the same effect. The type of inference you use when you reason retrodictively from effect back to causes is known as, in logic, an abductive inference. Mm-hmm. Now, abductive inferences can be grossly underdetermined. There can be many more causes that might explain the same effect. And in that case, you're stuck. Then circumstantial evidence isn't very compelling. But the historical geologists and evolutionary biologists in the 19th century refined that method, and they did so by showing that if you compared competing hypotheses against often a wider ensemble of evidences, you could narrow down the candidate explanations, and in the best of cases, you could infer to a best explanation. This method, known as the method of multiple competing hypotheses, is used instinctively by people in, for example, cosmology or evolutionary biology. And it does allow us, in some cases, to make very definitive inferences about the causal events in the past that explain the ensemble of clues and evidences that we have in the present. So circumstantial evidence can be very powerful, and it can be dispositive if you're in a position to make an inference to the best explanation, where you have, after an examination of an ensemble of clues, only one plausible explanation for the evidence at hand.
Right, and I see this a lot in the kind of fallacy of insufficient evidence playing out, but more on a practical level. In other words, you might find a lot of scientists, as you know, it's mentioned in the book, and some of the most preeminent scientists are mentioned in this book. Are some of them are friends of mine, despite the folks that I associate with in my off time, and yet they'll say things like, I'll bring up Sir Roger Penrose. He hasn't commented specifically on this book, but he was, one of the first, if not the best, to really popularize this idea of the exquisite fine tuning or low entropy state of the early universe that seems in great conflict with the theory, of inflation, which seems to suggest that, the entropy created during this early evolutionary process in the universe of its expansion by, 35 orders of magnitude in a microscopic fraction of a second, that's almost, a death blow to that theory. And you do mention those concerns in the book as kind of reasons to doubt the kind of universe from nothing, which we'll get into in just a bit. However, what you don't talk so much about is that Sir Roger came up with a alternative cosmology, which does away with the evidence, or does away with this, disposes of the entropy challenge to the inflationary cosmology. And it actually involves a universe with no beginning, a multiverse in time, which he calls a cyclic universe, which he calls conformal cyclic cosmology, featuring an innumerable number of aeons, or eons, as we would say in the States. And but I don't see much made of that. In fact, I see, predominantly the evidence that you put forth in the book for a singular origin of the universe, which, at first blush might be considered, kind of consistent, if not proved or posited by the Bible, specifically the Old Testament. So what do you make of the fact that what one cosmologist can do, another can undo? In other words, we used to think the universe was infinite, was static, unchanging. Hubble, the standard lore, comes along, shows even Einstein was wrong. So any point, and now then later on, folks like Beta and Gamow came up with the theory of the evolution of the very early synthesis of elements. Then we had Hoyle, who's in the book, and Burbage, my late great colleague here at UCSD, coming up with a quasi-steady state universe. And we see this going on and on. And then we had inflation. Now we have cyclic cosmology, or the bouncing cosmology of Paul Steinhardt, is also in the book. So tell me, why should we trust this science, this argument that you're making right now, when history shows time and time again, as Mark Twain said, that cosmology at least is rhyming, that it's dangerous to say there was a single beginning, despite all the proofs in there. There's counterproofs from everybody else. So why should we trust the cosmology, which you thoroughly explore and explain in this book? It's really a magnificent treatment of our current understanding. But again, Stephen, it's our current understanding, and what one cosmologist can do, in the past, another can do better now.
That's a great question. First, I do address the cyclic cosmology of Penrose, first in a long footnote, and then I have extended research notes that go with the book. They're going to be posted online, and so it's obviously very important to keep current with the most current things. And I can come back to that in a bit. But the big picture, broad stroke answer to your question is that what I've done is I've made an argument for the theistic implications of modern cosmology that does not depend upon a specific conclusion about there being a beginning or not. What I have constructed is what philosophers sometimes call a robust argument, meaning that multiple predicates lead to the same conclusion. And so I show that as best, I make the argument from a preponderance of evidence, both from observational cosmology and from theoretical physics, drawing on the singularity theorems of the 1960s and 70s, which are conditional, and they're conditioned upon general relativity, and there are reasons that we might not extrapolate all the way back to the beginning if we accept that there could be a quantum theory of gravity in the early, you know, pre-Planck time part of the universe. But I also make the argument that the back extrapolation that is being made in observational cosmology that gets us to a Big Bang, and the movement towards an infinite curvature, which is the implication of the singularity theorems, are indicators of a beginning. And then there's also a third line of argument, which is the Borg-Guth-Velenkin theorem that doesn't depend upon the kind of energy conditions that are necessary to make the singularity theorems work. It depends only on special relativity and basic geometric considerations. That also implies that there was a beginning. So we have multiple lines of evidence pointing to a beginning. But then I say, but if you don't accept that there was a beginning, or if you accept that there might not have been a beginning, then, and that in this era of quantum gravity, we should be exploring sort of quantum accounts of the origin of the universe. But then I show that those accounts of the universe, though they've been promulgated by sort of overt scientific materialists, they actually have latent theistic implications, certainly idealist implications. If you want to say that the universe has come out of a universal wave function, and then you have to ask, well, what is a universal wave function? If you say the laws of nature or laws of physics explain why there is a universe rather than nothing, well, what are the laws of nature? What kind of form can they have before there is an actual physical universe? And this is a question that was raised by Alexander Velenkin himself, one of the proponents of quantum cosmology. In fact, I've got the quote here. It's really provocative. In the absence of space, time, and energy, what tablets could these laws of nature be written upon? The laws are expressed in the form of of mathematical equations. If the medium of mathematics is the mind, does this mean that mind should predate the universe? But in that account, the universe comes out of a mathematical abstraction or a universal wave function, which is the solution to a prior mathematical equation, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is an analog to the Schrodinger equation in ordinary quantum physics. Velenkin makes this provocative observation, however. If we're saying that matter, space, time, and energy come out of essentially mathematics, and mathematics is the realm, is conceptual and exists in the realm of the mind, is our new account of the origin of the universe actually presupposing the existence of a prior intelligence or a mind? He doesn't answer that rhetorical question, but interestingly, Hawking, who is also a proponent of quantum cosmology, was sensitive to the same concern when he said, what puts fire in the equations that gives them a universe to describe? In our experience, math by itself has no causal powers. It's causally inert. So to posit math is to posit something that in our experience only exists in a mind, and minds are the things that do have causal powers. So have by circumventing one sort of cosmological account that leads to a theistic conclusion on one basis, namely that there was a definite beginning or singularity before which there was not matter, space, time, or energy to explain the origin of the universe. Now we have a different cosmological account, but it, for different reasons, implies the prior existence of mind. And as I show in the book, there's even some deeper logic to that, in that to get a universal wave function, you have to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a functional differential equation that has an infinite number of solutions and can only be solved if there are boundary constraints placed on that equation, and the boundary constraints are chosen selectively by the quantum cosmological modelers to give a universal wave function that includes a universe like ours, which is their condition of saying that we've explained the universe. So that input of information by the modelers, I think, is actually quite significant, because it suggests that to get a universe like ours out the other end, you've got to put information in. And the information is coming in the modeling from the mind of the theoretical physicist. So what I've shown is that there, in a sense, many roads to Rome. You've got different cosmological models, but they all have, if you probe them deeply enough, they have implications that are not strictly materialistic and point in the direction of mind.
That was UC San Diego physicist Brian Keating hosting Dr. Stephen Meyer on his podcast Into the Impossible. Look out for parts 2 and 3 of this conversation on upcoming episodes of ID the Future. Learn more about Brian Keating's work at www.briankeating.com. That's briankeating.com. And get your copy of Stephen Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, online at Amazon, bn.com, or wherever books are sold. Until next time, I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.